These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for February 3rd, 2018. The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is sponsored by Health IQ. It's an insurance company that was predicated on the idea that athletes live healthy lives and so should reap the rewards of lower insurance rates because of it. Using online quizzes to help pre-qualify you, Health IQ goes out and partners with insurers who also think you deserve to be rewarded for your lifestyle. So take a few moments, go over to healthiq.com/TOC and poke around a bit. You can read the FAQs, you can take a quiz, you can let Health IQ see how they can help you to lower your insurance rates. Remember that when you log on, go to healthiq.com/TOC. They will know that you are a listener, and that makes you even more special. So it's on with our show for this week. I'm going to cover a wide range of topics, from toddlers on balance bikes to the serious lack of understanding by law enforcement officials when it comes to bicycle crashes. And then we're going to have a preview of NABS for 2018. My first guest, Susie Marks, is the media voice of Strider Bikes. When the company was founded in 2007, the founder, Ryan McFarland, realized that his child needed and wanted to learn to ride. As with many children, training wheels were not working, and Strider was born. Today, the company has arguably become the first bike for thousands of kids from toddler through the 20-inch BMX machine. Then there are the Strider Cup races, the World Championship, the partnerships, the philanthropy, and so much more. Susie Marks will be with me in a few moments. After our short break, we're going to have a conversation with Mass Bikes' Richard Fries about the once again serious issues of police officials getting it wrong when a crash occurs. We pick up the story of Dr. Anita Kerman, who was riding in her lane, carefully navigating traffic. In a video compiled from traffic cameras in the area, Richard tells us about the 16 seconds that the driver of the truck had Dr. Kerman in his mirrors and yet turned right anyway, killing her. She never had a chance. What happened in the aftermath is the heart of our discussion about what it's going to take to enforce the laws, teach the police and prosecutors, and in effect, change the system. After another short break, it's time for the 2018 North American Handmade Bike Show, and this year, it's finally on the East Coast in Hartford, Connecticut. Kicking off on Friday, February 16th and running through the weekend, NABS is celebrating 14 years of beautiful bikes, interesting and educational seminars, and a look into the myriad ideas of the handmade machine. Show director Don Walker will give us the rundown on the event and how it has changed the industry. So it's off to South Dakota to speak with Susie Marks from Strider Bikes. Hi, Susie. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting because we don't always talk about children on the show, and I'm excited to be able to talk about it. Lots of our listeners have kids and grandchildren. I want them all to learn to ride a bike, as I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
Strider Bikes sort of took what Brian and I, my husband and I, have always told people when they're trying to teach a child to ride. You take off the pedals, you put the seat all the way down, and let them balance. And that is the way you teach children how to balance, and Strider just went with it.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the company, the background, and it's become a really, really important way for kids to learn how to ride a bike.
It absolutely has. So our company started in 2007. Our founder is Ryan McFarland. He is an avid motorcyclist and mountain biker and just loves everything with two wheels. So he had a two-year-old at the time, and he had, you know, a big wheel and a tricycle and a 12-inch bike with training wheels and all of the stuff because he was passionate about getting his kid to ride with him. And he just saw his son, Bodhi, struggling with these heavy bikes, and it just wasn't the right way to learn. So he took the 12-inch bike with training wheels, took off all of the cranks and pedals and all of that stuff, but also cut it and grinded it down all the way so that it was just bare bones, basically what the Strider looks like today, which is a simple, simple frame. So his two-year-old got on it, started just striding around right away. He would take it everywhere. He would ride it on the bike path, and people would stop and say, oh my gosh, that's so cool. I can't believe he's so little and riding that bike already. And he was just having so many people approach him about this that he decided, you know, this is an actual opportunity to get more kids on two wheels by starting this balance bike business. It's been 10 years. He hasn't looked back. He started it in the basement of his mortgage business, and now we're world headquarters in South Dakota, so it's awesome.
How is South Dakota today?
It's actually really nice today. It's about 50 degrees. There's no snow on the ground. It's a kind of a relief from that frozen tundra we're used to.
Well, we got your frozen tundra this week, so we woke up to like 4.5-6 inches of snow, which we were not expecting. Anyway, the bikes are really cute. I want to start with the model. So you have a baby bike, and then you go up to something called a 14X. Tell us, I think there are only like three models, but tell us what the models are and how they sort of fit into the growth of the child.
Yeah, our baby bike is actually a rocking base that you attach our 12-inch bike to. And that's for babies that are just starting to crawl and sit up and become comfortable with the bike. Once they get a little more used to the bike in their environment, they can get up on it. The base holds up the bike on its own, so then they can straddle it and use it essentially just like a rocking horse. Then they're totally used to the bike and being on it. Eventually, when the child is proficient walking, when they're about, it totally depends upon the child, but we suggest 18 months is about when they're ready to start on the 12-inch bike with no base at all. And again, they just walk with it until they get comfortable putting their bottoms down on the seat and balancing with it. And then after the 12-inch bike, we have the 14X, which is our newest model, and it has a removable pedal kit. Most kids that start on the 12-inch bike are proficient at balancing and they kind of need a bigger bike. However, if you're starting at 3 to 7 years old on the 14X, we suggest that you don't put the pedals on at all. Learn that balance, and then to put the pedal kit on, it's literally just one bolt that you bolt onto the bottom, and then it turns into a pedal bike from there. And we also have two other models, a 16-inch and a 20-inch bike. They don't convert to pedals, but they were developed more for individuals with disabilities that aren't able to just ride a typical pedal bike.
That's very cool, actually. I like that idea. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Susie Marks. She's with Strider Bikes. We're talking about children and bicycles, which is a really important thing. And the thing that got me to actually contact your company is your Strider Cup races. Because one of them's right here in Cleveland in May.
Yep.
So I'm hoping to go downtown and take a look at what you're going to be doing. Tell us what the Strider Cup races are.
Okay, so we've been doing Strider Cup races since 2011. Our first races were a dozen kids in Sarasota, Florida, and just for fun, but it has exploded. So we have 3 Strider Cup races in the United States that spread out throughout the racing season, and then a world championship. The races consist of a 2-year-old class, a 3-year-old class, a 4-year-old class, and this year we have a 14X open class, which will be in balanced bike mode. There's approximately 500 kids, just toddlers, that come and race, and their families come, and it's on different terrain. Usually it's on grass, and then it goes, you know, over curbs, and sometimes it goes through the water fountains that they have. We have them in usually open areas that have a farmer's market or a town square type, so that it's just a fun family environment. It's the public can see and come watch for free, and it's just fun for the whole family, even the spectators.
Well, so what actually happens during one of the races? Do you actually have winners and trophies and all of that stuff?
We do. We have a trophy for the top 10 finishers in each class. It runs similar to a BMX racing, where they have different motos and heats, and you know, if we have 200 2-year-olds, we kind of put them in different heats and get them into the main races until we can figure out who the top 10 races are. So there is friendly competition there. There's the top 10 trophy winners, and they get to stand on the podium and, you know, get the picture taken and all of that. But also every single racer gets a racing jersey with their registration, and then every racer gets a medal also when they finish the race.
That's cute.
Yeah.
Get them started. I wanted to know what happens when you go to a city like Cleveland, where we have a population that may or may not be able to afford a Strider bike. Are there opportunities for youngsters who don't actually have a Strider bike to get in on the events or to try one?
Yep, there absolutely is. So you're supposed to bring your own Strider bike and helmet. If you don't have one, we typically have a handful on loan where it's just first come, first serve. But in addition to the races, if you wanted to just come to try out the bike, we have what's called an adventure zone, and it's just a kind of a smaller version of the race where we have little ramps and places for the kids to try out the bikes, and that's all free. And also we'll have some rocking bases there for babies to try out, and then a 14X riding experience as well.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the Learn to Ride events. They're a little different.
Yeah, we have a Strider education curricula. We have an early elementary kind of curriculum that teaches kids how to ride from never being on a bike at all, starting with just walking with it. That's more geared towards our 12-inch bike. That they'll start walking with it, start putting their bottoms on the seat. That's for PE classes or Girl Scout troops or whoever wants to put on a learn to ride class. It's an actual curriculum that we have with 5 1-hour sessions, and it's got step-by-step process on how to teach a child to ride. We usually suggest that you do it once a week for 5 weeks so you can kind of practice what you learned in that hour and then come back the next week and do it all again. So it's amazing in a 5-week period the progression that you see from walking all the way to proficiently balancing on the bikes, and that's kind of what our Learn to Ride classes are about. In addition to that, I kind of mentioned it earlier, we have classes, also 5 1-hour sessions for individuals with disabilities, and that is also something that anyone can teach. We've had buddy walks through the National Down Syndrome Society, and Special Olympics uses our curriculums to teach individuals how to ride quite a bit, too. So that's really exciting.
It is exciting. Very exciting. I also want to talk about the Strider 2018 World Championships in Boulder. Who's going to be attending? How do you choose your championship racers or riders?
So anyone is able to come to our races. Just like the Strider Cup, you don't have to qualify. Qualifying is really just showing up the night before for packet pickup, kind of getting used to the race course. As intimidating, I guess, as it sounds, it really is just a fun toddler event. But people take this pretty seriously from other countries. We've had, you know, up to 10 countries. We've had kids from China and Ecuador and Slovakia and Canada and Colombia. And usually our biggest turnout internationally is Japan. They come as a team and they have matching racing jerseys and they take it pretty seriously, but they have a lot of fun and kind of turn it into a family vacation. And so we'll have a lot of local racers from Boulder, but we'll also have a lot of international racers as well.
But of course Japan would send a team, right?
Yeah, they're so good too.
The baby Olympics. The last thing, or one of the last things I want to talk about is sponsoring a Strider event and also the philanthropy that Strider does as a company. You partner with certain businesses to sponsor things. I don't know what the Cleveland event looks like on that end, but is that the type of event that will be partnered with here with companies here in Cleveland?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have big national title sponsors that we work with, and it can be from anything from a national title sponsor for the whole Strider Cup Racing Series to a class sponsor where you can sponsor just the two-year-old class, or like a product sponsor. Like Honey Stinger and Cliff Bars have both been product sponsors for us, so we put their items into the Strider gift bags that we hand out at the races. You know, we can have big sponsors like FedEx and GoPro, but we also like working with the brick-and-mortar businesses. And basically, if you're kind of in the outdoor industry and we think you're a good fit, we're willing to kind of work with anyone and you get names on number plates and on the backdrop for the podium. So it's pretty cool, yeah.
The last thing I want to talk about is your philanthropy program. I read somewhere something about $1 million, or was it 1 million bikes? Something has been, it's up there.
Yeah, we've donated about $1 million worth of bikes.
Okay.
To different organizations. So Ryan's always been kind of non-negotiable when it comes to being very generous. Every year, Strider Bikes gives 1% of our gross revenue to a rider fund, which directly gets kids on bikes. And through that, we've kind of seen some really awesome progression and independence that especially individuals with disabilities are getting more mobility. We had a high school teacher locally that had applied for a Rider Fund grant and got bikes for her classroom. And a lot of these 17, 18, 19-year-old kids who had been told that they wouldn't ride a bike are now have progressed to pedals. And, you know, if they're not driving cars, that really does increase their mobility. But in addition to the Rider Fund, there was a nonprofit organization called the Strider Education Foundation that was launched just last year in August, and that's a nonprofit organization that donates bikes to any organization, schools or nonprofits that need groups of bikes to teach kids how to ride.
I guess I do have one more question, and that is, where are these bikes made?
They're made in China.
Yes. Okay.
We have 4 distribution centers in the United States.
Okay. Well, this has been really interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing all these little toddlers and tots on bikes here in Cleveland in May. How can people find out more about the Strider Cup and the World Championship and perhaps a business or an organization that wants to partner with you?
You can go to our website. It's striderbikes.com. And then we have an events tab that tells all about the different races. We have one in Fort Worth. The one on May 26th is in Cleveland. We're going to have one in June in Charlotte, North Carolina. And if you want to know more about the Education Foundation, that's a separate website. It's StriderEducationFoundation.org. And of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram with the handle Strider Bikes.
Susie, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me and let me know about Strider Bikes, let our listeners know about Strider Bikes. And I hope it gets to be spring real soon in South Dakota.
I agree. I hope so, too. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Susie Marks joined me from the offices of Strider Bikes in South Dakota, where evidently it was warmer there than it is here in Northeast Ohio this week. Well, anyway, if you're interested in more information on these adorable little bikes, the events, and perhaps a way to partner with Strider, you can log on to StriderBikes.com. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, Mass Bike's Richard Fries and I will have a serious conversation about how and why we need to advocate for better education, laws, and enforcement for cyclists and pedestrians. Some of the statistics are mind-boggling. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
When was the last time you reviewed your life insurance? Are you happy with your current policy? HealthIQ.com thinks it can do better for you. Life insurance is a serious thing, and getting the right coverage that takes your life choices into consideration can make a huge difference. They don't just ask your age and whether or not you smoke. They ask intelligent, pertinent, and pointed questions and use science and data to help secure lower rates. Log on to healthiq.com/TOC or mention The Outspoken Cyclist when you're talking with your Health IQ agent. Remember, it's healthiq.com/TOC. We are back, and it's off to Boston for a conversation with Richard Fries, one of the smartest bike advocates I know. Hi, Richard. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It is good to talk with you, and not necessarily great right now. There's been another tragedy in Boston.
Well, it's actually an old tragedy. This goes back to 2005. The tragedy is just a continued lack of enforcement when you have crashes that involve people on bicycles.
Well, this was a fairly prominent person, a doctor, and you asked me to watch a video. I did watch it. It was very, very terrifying and didn't make me want to ride on Boston roads anytime. Tell us about the crash and then what's happened, because I know there have been some real problems with enforcement and the police.
Well, and this is not a Boston problem. This is a national problem. But, this crash involved a very popular route, Massachusetts Avenue. It runs, right through Harvard Square, through MIT, and goes right down to the medical area where, some of the best and the brightest minds we have are traveling. And they're traveling a lot by bike these days because it's the most efficient, most affordable way to go. We're not much of a college town here. And at the corner of Mass Ave and Beacon Street, too, really an iconic intersection, a Swiss surgeon, Dr. Anita Kerman, is riding her bike, doing everything legally, not racing, not trying to beat the truck. A truck overtakes her on the Mass Ave bridge, and he sees her about 30 seconds later, he stalls in traffic, and he stacks up at the light. While she continues on, and as she approaches on the right, he swings to the left and then swings to the right. And even though she comes to a dead stop about 1 foot from the corner itself, from the actual apex of the corner, his rear wheels gather her up and kills her. All of this captured on security camera footage that we were able to obtain, and we edited it, provided some graphics, and we called it 16 seconds because by our measurement, that's how long she sat in his rearview mirror, in his right rearview mirror, as she approached. And it's our belief that he should have been charged. He left the scene. No charge. I mean, this guy probably would have been charged more for, people are getting charged more for parking tickets right there than he was charged for killing somebody.
So what has happened since then? Obviously, there has been just some huge backlash from the cycling community. Is there any remedy to going back that far? I mean, we're now talking 2005. We're talking like 13 years, a long time.
15.
Oh, 2015.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking going on 3 years.
Well, the police report, they take a long time. And this police report took 2 years. And this is where it gets a little curious. The police report came out, and because we knew that there was video evidence, we were expecting a different finding. We were really hoping this would start to assemble some court precedent for actually charging drivers. Do we expect murder charges? No. But leaving the scene? Yes. Failure to yield? Some type of a citation. How about a ticket? How about a driver's license suspension? How about something like that? So we were expecting to have something good, and then when it came out, the police report, and we had to file a written request to get the police report, they placed 100% of the blame on the cyclist.
Wow. I mean, anybody watching that video can see that she was obeying traffic laws, that she was doing all the right stuff. I don't understand. So you have this video, you've given it to all the authorities, and now it's coming back around on Facebook. That's where I saw it. That's why I contacted you again. Or you contacted me this week. So what is happening now? Obviously there is some uproar somewhere.
Nothing. Well, we went to the Boston police, and we were like, we really think you got this one wrong. Could we meet with you? And we tried more than 12 times, starting back in mid-November. We pleaded with them to meet with us, to review this, to really talk. And we developed a line-by-line narrative as to why they got this wrong, why they bungled this investigation, and what laws they misinterpreted, what road markings they did not understand. They misinterpreted what a sharrow was. They misinterpreted what the law states. You know, it really comes down to this, Diane. Putting your turn signal on does not absolve you of responsibility to use due caution. This guy's driving a 48-foot trailer.
Right.
If I drive a station wagon, I check my mirrors. All this guy had to do was to check the right mirrors. So, but nope, they put all the blame on them. Now, our reason for doing this is threefold. So anyhow, just to back up, we just put it out there. We called a press conference and put it out there. And we had every major network affiliate. We had the Globe, the Herald. We were the front page of the Boston Herald. You know, if you can pull it down to put it on your site. And we were on the NPR affiliate. We've just been all over the AM talk shows. It's been really profound. It's really moved a lot of people to talk. And that was our third goal. Just create a dialogue to where people start to think about checking their damn mirrors. But we also think this is a good chance for us to create a teachable moment for police. We haven't updated our state police guides since 2008. We didn't even have a sheriff on the ground in 2008 here in Massachusetts. But we want this case to be heard. We think this belongs in our courtroom. Are we saying the guy needs to be convicted? We don't know, but it deserves a day in court. And we need this precedent. We need court precedent to be established in America.
Is anyone willing to pick that up and run with that ball?
Well, right now we're sort of stuck. The DA will. I think you have to understand the realpolitik that the DA has to work with the police department every day. The Suffolk County DA has to work with the Boston police. I get it. There's a relationship there, and it's not going to do them any good to take issue with a police report. It's really upon the police report to maybe revisit it, to see if they can be bigger than in terms of their capacity to examine this. I doubt it's going to happen, but I got to tell you, Diane, we have another one coming up. It's the Joe Lavins case in Cambridge, another large vehicle that killed a rider in October of 2016, October 5th, 2016. So now one of the things we have to look at is this publicity is really important because you can't get a fair jury in America.
Yeah.
So the battle's for public opinion. Sometimes you can't tell people, you got to show people.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Richard Fries. He is the director of Mass Bike in Massachusetts, in Boston. We are talking about some pretty high-profile crashes that have actually killed riders and that are not being prosecuted in a fair fashion. It certainly doesn't seem like it. Well, so this second case, the one from October of 2016, what's happening with that? Where is that right now?
That is right now. The delay has taken so long that the civil case has started again. What's unique about the Kerman case is that normally you get the criminal case and then there's a civil case.
Right.
The Kerman case, they settled. They rushed to settle. There was a very large settlement, not disclosed, the private settlement. The insurance company looked at this video, the same video we were able to get access to, and they're like, how much? Just get us out. So for the DA to say, we don't think we could get a conviction on this, we're not going to bring it to trial, which is what they said, this is almost like the Philadelphia Eagles forfeiting. And then you have the Patriots saying, we're not even going to go to Minneapolis. We don't think you can win. When it's already the insurance company has won, you know, or the insurance company has lost, I should say.
Right.
They just paid. They saw it. So we found that curious, that tactic. We feel there's pretty strong evidence to get some type of a charge. So with Joe Lavins, this is a case, it's curious because I came upon it about 10 minutes after it happened.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, pretty gruesome incident, but very similar. Driver, large 18-wheel, you know, truck during rush hour coming into a crowded city and drives right over an immunologist who was famous for riding, you know, in a very safe and courteous and law-abiding manner. So we're waiting to see. The civil case, because it's taking so long, they've just embarked on the civil case in that one. So we'll wait and see. A big issue here, Diane, is that, and there's been some curiosity with the advocacy groups. There is a current trend in advocacy, of bicycle advocacy, to really focus on engineering. I think it's a very noble enterprise and very important to do that, but not to focus on enforcement. I tend to believe that when you really look at the cornerstones of great European bike law or bike, you know, conditions and bike culture, it was the notion of presumed liability that took hold in the Low Countries. And that's why you have two to four deaths per 100,000 population in European countries that have adopted that. And here in America, you have over 10 deaths per 100,000 population.
For those who don't know, explain presumed liability.
Sure. because
it really is an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Basically, the heavier vehicle is deemed to be at fault until proven otherwise. Real simple. The cement mixer, you know, if there's a crash, you deem, well, the guy driving the cement mixer has to take extra caution. We have it backwards in America. You and I have spoken about this.
Yes.
We basically put the fault on the victim. This is, legally, we are victim blaming. Person shouldn't have been wearing headphones. Person, you know, wasn't paying attention. Person shouldn't have, you know, for any reason, we tend to blame the most vulnerable people in our society. And we put the burden of proof on the dead person.
Yeah, like he or she can speak for herself other than to say, now I'm dead, right?
Yeah. And it's actually a really common thing for just riders that are injured. If you do any outreach on it, you'll find people are concussed. People are, you know, being put into ambulances and their statements aren't being taken. Their statements aren't being taken well. A lot of it has to do with, there's a few things here that we could work on. One is basically, let's really get good crash protocol. The way we get, you know, sexual assault, there's a real strict protocol as to how you deal with it. So let's start to deal with bikes and pedestrians and get some really good law enforcement training on how to respond to a crash. Start there. Don't assume that they're guilty, because there seems to be an assumption of guilt was placed on the bike rider.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Not too long ago, I can't remember, I think I spoke with her attorney, but there was a woman in California who went through exactly that. This BMW hit her and then sued her for hurting his car. And she settled with the insurance company and does not remember much when she was to give her statement. So that the statement was sort of fuzzy and the police did not follow up. And she ended up being terrified that it was going to cost her everything because this guy was suing her for damaging his car, even though he hit her. So I understand what you're saying, and that, I agree, needs to change. What is happening legally countrywide? I know Boston seems to be very active, or Massachusetts is very active. I don't really hear much going on in Cleveland, but you have California, you have the Carolinas, you have a huge law network. What is happening? Is there a way to, like, turn this into some sort of national?
Yeah, we need a good court case. That's what we need. We need a really good case, and we need one state to take the lead on this. That's where it starts. And I don't see it right now. I think the state of Washington might be the closest. There's a pretty pretty good attorney up there named Bob Anderton, who is a cycling attorney, and he's been leading the charge for just this, presumed liability. So I think he's getting farther along than anybody else, but I think we're looking for a couple of really good cases. What's interesting is that Canada, which is a legal derivative of the British system that we are, that we use, Canada remains in a similar system to us, but Ontario did adopt presumed liability. And I want to say that was about 5-6 years ago, but I have to check on that. But I know that in Ontario, they've adopted it. So I think you're starting to see some cracks. What we really have to do to the issue is that we really have to get people to stop tolerating roadway deaths as an acceptable casualty figure. The Vision Zero movement's very important right now. We really need people, not bike riders, everybody, to stop accepting highway deaths as just an unfortunate casualty. We can fix this, and other countries have done it. As I always ask, I'm asking a lot of people in this Facebook dialogue, why does Sweden have 304 traffic deaths a year, and we had in 2016, and we had 40,200 nationwide?
It's an unbelievable number, isn't it?
Correct.
It's terrifying. So let me. I had a thought here.
That's all right. I have them all the time.
Yeah, I know, but this was supposed to take the conversation a little bit farther, and it was a little bit broader. And I lost it when you gave me that number. I'm hearing 40,000 compared to 300. It's like not even
right.
It's so ridiculous. Oh, I know what it was. So I wanted to know what you think about the concept of putting roads on what they call road diets, of taking trucks like this 48-foot trailer that killed this doctor off of those kinds of streets, that slowing down traffic, that kind of thing.
Well, you do have some interstate freight policies that are really hard to beat. They've got a really strong lobby, the trucking lobby. They also have a really hard and very important job.
That's
true. It is difficult. And I think we stuff them into real curious environments where and expect them to do things that are nearly impossible. And I do think it's a hard job. And actually, truck drivers should be allies with the bicycle community, because we're going to help get single occupant vehicles off the road, which is really the issue. The issue is not bikes and trucks. The issue is trucks are stuck in traffic all the time because we don't have enough bike, ped, transit, you know, things that really can alleviate congestion. So, but I do think you have to look at some delivery times. I think you have to look at load-in times. I think you have to really look at a lot of the European models. And I think engineering is a big part of it. I think education is a big part of it. Most states don't even ask people signing up for licenses any questions about bicycles or pedestrians and their and the rules. And you've seen it, Diane, when you go into the comments section of any Facebook conflict, there's people out there that just don't know the law, and they're out driving too.
You have police who don't know the laws.
21st century is going to be interesting. Diane, it's legal for... We also have a real big problem that we have confused to be a right instead of a privilege.
Right. That is true. I totally agree.
That's a big problem. You know, it's legal to text while driving. In 23 states, it is legal to text and drive while you're operating a school bus.
Oh, my goodness. Even in the states where it's not legal, I'm not sure they're enforcing it.
Well, that's another thing, primary versus secondary enforcement. This world of advocacy is hard, day. You just start pulling
up.
Yeah,
I know. I know, and you took it on, buddy. You took it on for all of Massachusetts.
We're getting there. But I will say that part of this is that, you know, we really have to get out there into the mainstream when we have cases like this. So wherever they are, I think Bob Majorski would be a great, great guest of yours. Very articulate attorney. Megan Hotman out of Boulder, Colorado, another great cycling attorney. But this is really important. We need more cases to get higher profile, higher publicity. You know, because we have issues where juries, we can't find a neutral jury. We can't find a jury that does not have a bias against cyclists.
Which is a real problem. Because they're obviously just uneducated about cycling. And that,
yeah, well,
that's
I mean,
issue.
There's $40 billion of advertising goes at them every year, and that's just from the domestic auto manufacturers every year. Not to mention the lobby and the PR.
Every manufacturer, you know. every car manufacturer. I mean, how many car ads do you see every single day on television? And it is obnoxious, to say the least.
And watch the news.
And the news, that's right.
The news is where you have all the reports on all the crashes every day, and they are offset by an equal number of pictures of convertibles on the Pacific Coast Highway.
That's exactly
with
right.
Beautiful people. Or they're in a desert.
I hate this conversation, and I love it. You know, I love talking to you, and I love hearing your points of view. And I will follow up with the two attorneys. I mean, I've spoken with quite a few attorneys. We haven't had this exact conversation, but I like the idea of finding either a class-type action or a high-profile case that will make the national news and make people say, wait a minute, it's time that happened.
Yeah.
Our time's coming. Our time's coming. Well, have a wonderful
right.
day. I know you have a meeting coming up, and I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. We will talk again, as always.
You do a great job. Thanks, Ann.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Richard Fries joined me from the offices of Mass Bike. Massachusetts is doing so many things right, it seems, and yet here we are. I'll keep following this story, and maybe the tipping point isn't too far off to make us all safer out on the roads. If you want to watch the video that Mass Bike posted about Dr. Kerman's crash, you can go to massbike.org/Anita Kerman video. It isn't pretty, and it speaks volumes. So let's take another short break, and then it's off to Kentucky to talk with show director Don Walker as he prepares for 2018 NABS in Hartford, Connecticut.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. So it must be time for NABS.
Oh, Lordy, yes it is. Here we go again.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Yeah, I'm as ready as I'm ever going to be. My show bikes are done. You know, the only thing we got to do is, put some headsets in a couple and build up one or two. But, you know, I'm not brazing at midnight tonight. So that's the thing that matters.
Yeah, it looks like you're ahead of the game this year.
Yeah, surprisingly so.
Yeah, well, this year, and this is pretty exciting news. If for those who do not know, the show is finally coming to the East Coast. You're going to be in Hartford, Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about the venue and the dates.
Sure. Venue is downtown at the Connecticut Convention Center, downtown Hartford. And the dates are February 16th through the 18th.
I was looking at the list of exhibitors. It is humongous. How many exhibitors are there?
I lost track somewhere around a week or so ago, but I want to say we're close to 140.
That's
yeah,
great.
We're doing okay. You know, we did lose quite a few guys from the West Coast, which we anticipated would happen, but some of the main players are still coming. So that's all that matters.
Well, and you've picked up some new East Coast builders, a couple I've never heard of and a couple who probably haven't exhibited in the past. There are some interesting exhibitors that aren't exactly just custom builders, but they have sort of a holistic perspective around cycling. For example, Cal Poly Mechanical Engineering, the University of Iowa, Connecticut Cycling Advancement Program. What did these types of exhibitors bring to NABS?
Well, you know, the colleges, they are bringing some of their students' projects. So they are showing bikes that were actually made there at school in engineering class, and they're bringing all kinds of ideas. Let's face it, you know, not everybody that is a frame builder
was an engineering student. So they are coming at some of these problem-solving areas on, you know, how to do certain joints on a bike, you know, from an engineering standpoint. And, you know, young, fresh minds are, I think, some of the best in the business, you know, and they're bringing a lot of engineering skills and, you know, ideas. So I think they're kind of going to be at the vanguard here, you know, very soon of the industry. As far as the CCAP, that is our local nonprofit partner. They're providing us with several volunteers, but they are providing us with a lot of entertainment as well. They have parties, after-hour parties, I believe, scheduled for every night of the week that we're there. So
cool.
they're bringing a lot of entertainment to us, and they're doing a lot of local marketing. You know, they're just really doing a great job, you know, as far as being a partner, you know, and a great group of people there that, you know, we're just thrilled to be, you know, partnered up with.
That's good. It also encourages younger people to get involved in our business. So, you know, the list of exhibitors is way too long to go through here, but I'd like to look at one specific example. What do you know about this bamboo beanie? It's a kid's bike that grows with the kid.
I don't know a whole lot. I looked at the website briefly, you know, during the application process, and like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. It looks like it's really a well-thought-out and engineered product. I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, seeing it in person and really getting a good feel for it.
Yeah, yeah, it really does look cool. What's Don Walker bringing this year? You always have something fabulous. I think the last time we talked, you were partnering with somebody. I can't remember who it was, but you were doing something really cool, like a team bike.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that was last year. Well, I'm sure you know Matt Haldeman that works in my booth every year. He's a track racer up in Seattle.
Right.
Matt is also one of my best friends and one of my best customers. Last year, he wanted a replica of Vyacheslav Ekimov's bike from the 1988 World Championships.
That's right.
And so that's what we ended up building. It ended up being a campy build for their best Campagnolo contest. So, you know, if you're unaware of the best Campagnolo contest, Campagnolo is one of our sponsors, and you enter your bike into their contest, and it's supposed to be, you know, the best build using all Campagnolo components. Well, we ended up, you know, running short on finding Campagnolo disc wheels from the 1988 era. We ended up borrowing them from our friends over at the Pros Closet. And those came off of Steve Hegg's pursuit bike from, I believe it was 1990 or 92 or something like that. So, you know, we were beg, borrowing, and stealing to get that bike built up. So, at any rate, that was last year. But we liked the bike so much, and we wanted it to actually look like it was ridden when Ekimov rode it. So we've come across the old fluid disc, and anybody that's familiar with track racing back in the 80s knows the fluid disc was the Russian carbon fiber disc. It almost looks like it's wood fiber, and it's got the bizarre 666 logo. You know, I'm pretty sure they're not Satan worshippers over there, but
okay, good.
The logo is pretty cool. And then we found a circa 1988 sew-up rim, you know, 26-inch, for the front wheel, and we found a Campy Sheriff Star Hub. Literally, the bike looks exactly the way that Ekimov rode it at the World Championships that year. That is coming. So now it's hashtag 1988 lives again.
Right. And again and again.
Yeah, yeah. So that this will be the final appearance at the show for that. But, you know, because it was seen out, you know, west in Salt Lake City, we're planning on, you know, entertaining more folks, you know, in New England with that particular build. Other than that, we've got my booth will be stocked with a variety of my usual offerings. I'll have a team road bike, a team track bike, a team cyclocross bike, and then we've got a couple other things. You know, I'm bringing the British Racing trike back as well. So doing some repeats, but, you know, happy to show some of my capacity as a builder.
Repeats may not be so repeat to people who have never been to NAVS. I mean, we've got a whole new audience this year. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Don Walker. He is the founder of the North American Handmade Bike Show. And this is what, year 13?
This is year 14.
14. Oh, it started in 2005. You have to count that. Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Did you ever imagine when you did this in, I think it was Austin the first year, that it was going to do this?
You know, I didn't. Honestly, Diane, I was figuring we're just a bunch of frame builders. Who's going to want to come and see us? And yet every year it just, you know, it keeps growing. It takes on a new energy with every, you know, location that we go into. It's really different. And, you know, I love the fact that we are able to visit different regions, different specific cities, and they all have their own bike culture. And that helps feed the energy of the show when we come, you know, come into town. So it's been great. You know, I love it. And honestly, this is the longest tenure at a job I've ever had.
That's even funny.
So
that's hilarious, Don. Who knew, right?
Who knew?
I'm not going to let you go until we talk about your seminar program. And then I actually want to talk to you a little bit about something that is more sort of holistically industry related. So let's talk about your seminar program. You have three seminars that you are targeting specifically for women to come and hear. Tell us about those.
I got to tell you, it's been a weird year with the whole Harvey Weinstein thing. You know, I dare I bring that up on a bicycle program?
Sure.
But, you know, it's been a really strange time. Our country's kind of a weird crossroads, maybe. You know, I mean, everybody's complained, you know, that the women have been, you know, treated unfairly with their salaries and, you know, what's expected of them. And honestly, I mean, I totally understand and it totally makes sense. And it resonated with me. And I was like, you know, maybe now is the time to really, you know, start focusing on women, because if we're going to grow this sport that we all love, cycling, we're going to need, you know, to bring in some more, I use the word bodies, but we're going to want, you know, more people involved. There's only so many, you know, men that are going to be in it. So, you know, the next, you know, segment would obviously be, you know, the ladies. And I think that's really going to be the future of the sport.
I think you perhaps are right. I mean, we are at least 50% of the population. As I remember, there will be a professional seminar. There will be one about getting women riding more. My friend Joni is going to be on a panel that talks about women who are already in the industry and are successful. It's not just about riding a bike. It's more about how women are going to be included in the entire bicycle culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Good.
Really looking forward to it. It's, you know, I feel it's probably long past time. Because all of our seminars prior to this were just generalized, you know. But I think, you know, having the women specific seminars or symposium, if you will help grow the sport.
Yeah, let's hope so. Let's hope so. So I want to get your thinking about the bicycle industry itself. How important has a show like NABS become to the health and future of cycling? I see Interbike is faltering. Brick and mortar stores are struggling. You really sort of go direct to the consumer. It is a consumer show. So how important has NABS become? And it's a model.
You know, I'm not sure how important it's become. I just know that I feel the calling to continue to put pressure on making the show as best as I can for the exhibitors and as best as I can for the consumers. And if we can overlap and make it, you know, grow and make it so more people are bicycle conscious or whatever, then I feel like I'm doing the right thing. I probably can't get into too much, you know, on, you know, Interbike or anything like that. You know, have they faltered? Yeah, I think staying in Vegas as long as they did was a big detractor for them. That's really all I want to say about that.
Well, that's interesting, because your model has always been to move the show year to year. And it never occurred to me until you said it right now that wouldn't that have been something a little bit smarter for the wholesale end of the industry as well as retail?
Well, you know, I mean, we're two different shows, because Interbike really is a industry show.
Right.
Whereas we are a consumer and industry show. So, you know, our first clientele coming through the door, you know, as attendees are usually all just, you know, Joe consumer. But, you know, as you've been to the show on numerous occasions, you walk around and you see people that you know in the industry and you go, oh, okay, I see what they're doing. You know, and there's product managers walking around taking pictures of the developments that the frame builders have done, you know, for that particular year. And it ends up on next year's product line on some of the bigger manufacturers. That's probably my least favorite part of this show is the fact that, you know, that they're not even coming up with their own ideas. They have to use, you know, the frame builders' ideas. But apparently it's been like that, you know, since, you know, bicycle shows have been going on anyway. So
yeah, probably. Yeah. So have you had to make changes in your business over the last few years because of the economy or any directions in the bike business, or are you pretty much still focused on and doing the same things you've always done?
Well, yes and no. We're going to be evolving more this next year than we have in years past. In years past, we have very much so been a dyed-in-the-wool frame builder show. But, you know, there's been years when, you know, we haven't had as many people come through the door. You know, we've discussed internally what needs to be done, and we think that, you know, in the future, there will be some changes made, definitely for the 2019 show, that will incorporate some more open-minded ways of getting people through the door. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to be going and standing on the street corner, you know, handing out tickets. Hey, here you go, go on through. Because, you know, we're still trying to get good, qualified consumers through the door so people get orders. But we're going to have to, you know, make some changes to, you know, get more people through the door.
Well, I will be interested to see what that is. But this is the year we're focused on right now. Let our listeners know how to find out more information about NABS 2018.
Sure. They can go to the website, which is NAHBS. That's short of North American Handmade Bicycle Show, NAHBS.com. And it should have all the information on there. We do have a Facebook page, facebook.com/NAHBS/. We have an Instagram page as well, and we're posting pictures of some really beautiful bikes. We'll do news articles. Say we're always trying to stay ahead of the curve when it comes to the news and what's going on. But back to, you know, if you don't mind me, you know, going back to the question you asked earlier about, you know, why bike shops are faltering, I think that there's a couple of issues at hand. And one of those is that as we've noticed a big trend in online sales. So if people come into a bike shop, they might be what's called showrooming, figuring out what size shoe they wear, and then they'll order it off of Amazon or some other online venue. That has something to do with it. But I think the other thing is that cycling as a whole has some very serious issues right now, here, at least here in the United States. And that is the fact that people are scared to ride on the roads now. With distracted drivers, you know, people texting while they're driving, et cetera, cyclists are getting hit and killed, struck and killed by cars at, you know, an alarming rate. You know, I can't tell you how many times I see it, you know, in my Facebook feed. Hey, so-and-so, cyclist down, you know, whatever. It's frustrating to me because it's something that can be fixed. And it's something that I think that, you know, maybe the phone manufacturers or, you know, maybe AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, whoever, T-Mobile, maybe they can figure out that if a phone is traveling on the GPS more than 20 miles an hour, then obviously the person is driving and therefore, you know, the phone shouldn't be active.
Right.
I think that needs to happen. And then the second thing I think needs to happen is that if you're a motorist and you strike a cyclist, whether, you know, you were distracted or not, there needs to be a penalty. There needs to be jail time involved. You know, if you kill a cyclist, you know, it should be murder because you are in a vehicle that, you know, weighs, a few thousand pounds and you're most of the time going up against, you know, a 150-pound person, you know, that has no protection around them. I think that's really why I feel that our industry is hurting, you know, right now is because of that. People are just afraid to be out on the road riding because they, you know, they think they're going to get struck by a car and killed.
Interestingly enough, one of the other guests on the show this week is Richard Fries. That is the conversation about a doctor who was hit and killed by a truck. And so we talk about something called presumed liability, which in Europe means the heavier vehicle is always considered at fault until proven otherwise. And that is not the way it is in the United States. So very interesting that you would look at the situation in that way.
Well, thanks, Diane. You know me well enough to know that whenever, you know, I get riled up, I get passionate about things. And this is something that I am passionate about. I'm not happy, you know, with the state of things here. People that you know, strike a cyclist and kill them, and the police report says that it was an accident. Well, I'm sorry, if you don't know how to drive a car and not hit somebody, that's really not an accident. That means that you are incapable of driving, and something's got to change. I love this sport. I love what I do. I love all those around me that, you know, do the same thing, whether it be riding or building bikes, you know, and I don't want to, you know, see that post on Facebook that, you know, one of my friends has passed on because they were hit by a car.
Right.
And that, you know, driver not get any sort of penalty. You know, that's my concern. I don't want to see anybody perish again being struck by a car while they're out doing, you know, the sport that they love doing. But I think I'm just as passionate about, you know, there being a penalty. There's got to be some sort of law that needs to be, you know, passed nationwide. So it's a federal law. You strike a cyclist, you know, you've got to go to prison. How do you lose control of your car if you knew that they were there?
Well, that's a good question. I think it needed to be asked. I think it needs to continue to be asked. And I think that there needs to be some education among the prosecutors and police and the laws.
It's a little bit late now, but, you know, maybe for 2019 show, what we can do is see if we can get, you know, as many lawmakers and as many, you know, advocates for safe cycling and maybe even some phone, you know, representatives, you know, together at NABS and have a conference on it. You know, how do we solve this problem?
What a great idea, Don.
I'm perfectly happy with donating the meeting place for it. We just got to get the word out and make it happen.
Let's talk about that for 2019.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, get back to getting ready for the show. And thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with me today. We'll see you in Hartford, Connecticut, February 16th through 18th at the Connecticut Convention Center for the 2018 North American Handmade Bike Show. Thanks, Don Walker.
Diane, thank you so much for having me
all
again.
Right.
It's always a pleasure. We'll see you there.
All righty. Bye-bye. If you want more information on NABS 2018, log on to nahbs.com. You can see a list of the exhibitors. You can look at the seminars, get directions, purchase tickets, and drool over the gorgeous bikes. So thanks to all my guests this week, Susie Marks from Strider Bikes, Richard Fries from Mass Bike, and Don Walker. We'll be back next week with a conversation with the founder of VeloFix. And we'll take a gourmet trip to Italy with Turissimo Bike Tours. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.